Thanks. Let me know if I just call on the phone and walk you through this. At any rate, my name is Stefan Savage. I'm going to give a talk based on the research done by a cast of thousands. I wanted to first take a moment to say something about myself for the people who don't know me. When your name is Butler Lampson, you can just say, you know, I'm Butler, and that actually means something. In my case, it means something less. At any rate, I got my PhD up at the University of Washington, worked in a whole variety of areas spanning networking, operating systems, and computer security. Most of my time these days is spent in the context of this center we built down here called Seaside, which focuses on large-scale internet attacks, bots, worms, denial of service, viruses, and so forth. I've also touched the industry side. I co-founded two companies, one of which was a colossal failure. I raised and spent $15 million, and it all went into the toilet, which is an anti-denial of service company. The other one was a successful company that defended against worms called NetSIP that has since been sold to Cisco. I'll talk a little bit about that technology today when I talk about this problem in overall context. All right, so with that, and people should just interrupt me because by definition, I have too many slides and I go off on tangents. And so we'll kind of adjust as the talk goes on. All right, so if you spend any time reading the media about security threats on the internet, there's very much a gloom and doom sense. You can go to any online forum and read about worms and spyware and phishing and viruses and extortion and so on and so forth. And there is something of a backlash, particularly in government, saying, well, you know, this is just a bunch of people crying wolf and nothing is that bad. And I'm going to take the opposing point of view that says that the Chicken Little view is actually incredibly optimistic. And I'm going to try to make my point by way of a metaphor. So let's suppose you are a zoologist and you have encountered a new species in a previously unknown land, and the species has the following characteristics. It has incredibly poor genetic diversity. It's heavily inbred. You know, brothers and sisters marry each other. There's only three lines of different stock in the gene pool. It lives in the center of a hot zone that has tons of infectious pathogens being mutated at an ongoing rate. But there's these very strange physics in this particular part of the world where the species exists, and that is that disease can be transmitted instantaneously. So as soon as you get a cold, everyone you look at gets a cold instantly. Unfortunately, in this area, the immune response is anywhere between 10 and a million times slower than the rate of infection. And then on top of it, this particular species has very poor hygiene practices. So if they see some glob of, you know, infectious pathogen on the ground, the first thing they do is they pick it up and rub it on their body and then go to their friend and say, here, would you like a bite? Now, let's suppose that you encountered this species and you were asked in your role as a zoologist, what is the long-term prognosis of this thing? It makes the panda bear look like a heavily adapted species. This thing is going to die off any day now. And the claim I'm going to make is that this is actually a far better situation when you carry on the metaphor than the average PC on the internet today. Because all of these things apply. We have poor software diversity. We have tons of infectious pathogens being developed. We can transmit disease far faster than we can defend against it. And no one does anything serious in terms of providing security on their machine. And on top of this, we have this unfortunate characteristic that diseases are not being mutated in some random fashion, but they're being designed explicitly. And it's really trivial to create a new disease, and there's a huge profit motive to do so. And when Dave Oxenis talked, he hinted at some of this, or he's actually explicit about some of it, and I'm going to look at that again as we go on. But the transformation versus, say, the computer security of a decade ago is that instead of situations where there were particular high-value resources that you tried to protect and you would, the name of the game was make it expensive for anyone to get access to those high-value resources, and you're really worried about the insider. Now the attacker can use automation to attack all of the systems at once. So you just say, I'm going to release something out there and have it attack everything. And the role of the defender is rather different. Now you need to protect any system that might gain access to something that you want to have private. And even those things that you might consider high-value resources, unless you have an incredibly draconian policy, there's no reason for you to really believe you know where those are. Right? Case in point, our ex-director of the CIA used to take stuff home on his laptop and plug it into broadband. And I don't know why we would expect the same would be any different for a Fortune 500 company or anything like that. So now our threats aren't insiders, although those threats continue to exist, but software vulnerabilities and naive users. So the technical enablers to make all this happen are really, there are really four of them. The biggest one is that the service model that the internet provides is one that's been tremendously successful, and that is anyone can send anything to anyone. It imposes no structure or restrictions. It means that any kind of application can be developed quite easily. No barriers to that. At the same time, it's an Achilles heel. I can send anything to anyone regardless. I don't have to have any relationship with them. There's no restriction on how many things I send, to whom, in what fashion. And so it's really easy. This is the instantaneous spread of disease aspect. And this comes about from the fact that, this is the way IP works. We also have extreme levels of homogeneity in our software base. This is a natural artifact of economics, but is a fact of life. So what it ends up meaning is any single bug translates into a mass vulnerability. So any bug in a system that some reasonable number of people use, any popular system, is a system that millions of people use. Even if you solve that problem, you have users that will gleefully click OK on almost any question they are asked. And so this is why email viruses of the form that says, hey, why don't you decrypt this thing and then execute it and then run it and type in your credit card numbers, all work. On top of this, we don't really have, to this day, we have very few meaningful defenses against any of this stuff. And the perpetrators don't really have to worry about any consequence, because there's effective anonymity and consequently minimal risk to be an online criminal. And then the tool of the technical enablers are the economic forces. So as Dave Oxmith alluded to, this is no longer something people do simply to entertain themselves, but it is a profit-making incentive. So everything from spam forwarding to credit card theft, personal identity theft, DDoS extortion, these are all a set of different things that are being built upon an underlying infrastructure of worms and bots and viruses and so forth, where the underlying infrastructure really is a compromised host. The ability to compromise a host is the underlying service platform, right? And there is a fluid third-party market for the exchange of compromised hosts. So the going rate for a host to proxy spam is somewhere between 3 and 10 cents per host per week, which sounds very cheap, except if you consider that you have, say, 25,000 bots, which is actually not that many for modern botnets to hold, that you can be making somewhere in the $40,000 to $130,000. For raw bots, I want to take someone's host, it can be a dollar up, and then you can do special orders. You can say, I would like a compromised host inside the FBI, and there are people who specialize in doing special orders. This creates this virtuous economic cycle that creates an incentive for people to do a better job at compromising hosts and a better job at protecting themselves against any defenses. And in turn, as it creates a stable platform, really creates a substrate for applications to be developed. So I think the right way for you to view what's going on in the internet over the last few years is that DDoS and spam and piracy, identity theft, and so forth, these are all applications upon a common service platform that is the ability to compromise these hosts and trade them and so forth. So here's an example of what kind of this modern form of service-oriented computing is all about. This is a post on NetNews for a guy who says, you know, I am offering to third parties the ability to knock out sites, the DDoS attack service. Right? And this is on an open forum. If you get closed forums, you get, you know, all kinds of different people innovating effectively on this platform to provide new kinds of services that they then charge money for. So kind of here's another example of I don't have the spam one. I can't go back. Go forward then. Interesting platform. Today I'm going to talk about acute outbreaks, which is really what I spend a lot of my time dealing with. So these are situations where you have some kind of infectious malware that's designed to actively spread from host to host in order to compromise the largest number of hosts that it can. So things like worms and viruses and so forth. And a lot of people try to come up with distinctions between all of these things. I actually find the distinctions very uninteresting. From my standpoint, these are all outbreaks of something infectious, and so I'm just going to use the word worm from now on. There are minor distinctions, but I think they end up not mattering. I'm going to particularly talk about epidemic spreading. This is where all of the hosts individually are trying to spread, because this is the fastest way to spread. It's the way to get the most bang for the buck, and is the way to do so far before any kind of reasonable human reaction can be involved. For slower infections, there are a number of other mechanisms you may bring to bear. For very fast infections, life is pretty grim. All right, so the remainder of today, I'm going to first kind of do a review for people who aren't familiar with worms and exactly how they work and how to think about them. I'm going to talk about the epidemiology of epidemic spreading on the network, and then the kinds of defenses that people actually build, both in real life and in the research. All right, so for those who don't know, a network worm is some kind of self-replicating program on the network. It either exploits some vulnerability in a host or the naivete of the user who happily will click OK. As soon as control is seized on the host that has been compromised, it repeats the process and tries to infect somebody else. All right, so first one host infects another, then both hosts can infect future hosts, then four hosts become infected, they can infect another four, and so on until the entire system gets infected. And the power of this approach is the independence of each host and the parallelism that gets expressed as additional hosts get infected. So, as usual, this is an idea that the sci-fi authors got long before the computer science community. So if you go back and look at the history of the term worm and virus in the computer context, they both come in the mid to early 1970s from people who are hypothesizing what the future of computing would look like. And it's really not until the 1980s that anyone decides what to do with it. A couple of guys, Schock and Huff from Xerox PARC, again, in typical Xerox PARC fashion, decide that, well, this will be a force for good. And so the Xerox PARC worm was one that went from machine to machine and made your machine better. Right, so they had a very positive view of how computing would work. Fred Cohen was the first one to really start talking about all the harm that these things could do. What could our self-replicating virus actually do to a system? And then in 1988, we have really the first large-scale outbreak of a worm from our good friend Robert Morris. And then the most amazing thing happened. After demonstrating this incredible power that, for all intents and purposes, shut down the internet for several days, nothing happened for 10 years. Right? Absolutely unexplainable. But 10 years goes by, and there's effectively no serious worm epidemic. In the early 90s, you first start to get significant.
So you think the fact that Morris was apprehended and fined had anything to do with that?
Sorry?
I wonder if you think the fact that Morris was apprehended and tried and fined had anything to do with suppressing worms.
You know, it might have. On the other hand, people writing viruses were doing like gangbusters during that time. So, it could. You never know. It's very hard to measure the deterrence effect of people being caught. If you look in the modern era, we've been catching a number of people. It does not seem to significantly reduce the number of new variants of malicious code that occur. But it's an interesting theory. My own theory is that Robert was ahead of his time, and that what happened in the 90s was that people generally discovered the internet. And so you get a broader group of people who actually start thinking about doing this kind of stuff. And you have the evolution of the virus community, which really was based on this notion that you would spread from floppy to floppy disk. You know, I would put my floppy in your machine, it would pick up a virus, and I would carry it along to the next place. And the internet became a vehicle for them to perpetrate the same kind of stuff. So in the 90s, you get email worms. Big ones, Melissa and I Love You, took over a million hosts, but they required the user to do something. Basically, to open this attachment and execute it. Summer of 2001, you have kind of the big worm outbreak of the 21st century, Code Red. It's actually a fairly uninteresting worm. It was a standard buffer overflow exploit. It picks a random address and then tries to infect that. We continue to do this on an ongoing basis. The first version, actually, of Code Red has this. This is a fascinating story. They had a bug in their random number generator, so every single instance of the worm used the same seed. So they all went in lockstep. They all went to exactly the same host. And so people posted, oh, this worm is a crap. You couldn't even get the random number generator, right? 18 hours later, Code Red version 2 comes out. They fixed the seed. Alright, so it takes over about 400,000 hosts in 10 hours, and then tries to mount an unsuccessful denial of service attack against a website. It continues to this day. If you go and you monitor any significant network, you will find Code Red. It's very hard to eradicate these things. It's harder than polio. If one schmuck plugs in a protected machine, and that becomes an ongoing bastion for it to live. Basically in perpetuity. This Code Red has this interesting characteristic that it went dormant for a 7-day period. So we had one, you know, only 6 more shopping days until Code Red emerges again and cameras down at computer center saying we want to watch Code Red reappear. At any rate, there was a huge amount of attention. This effectively energized a renaissance of worm construction. Suddenly, thousands of worms are being built. Code Red, Nimda, Slammer, Blaster, Witty, and just left and right, tons of things. Vantech registers a 6-time increase in malware variants in the time frame. You have ones that involve humans, the ones that are automatic. Just everything blooms after 2001. I'm actually going to skip this because I don't think it's that interesting. All right, so let's look at one other worm before we go into looking at this more abstractly. So in 2003, there was a worm called Slammer. Slammer was a really simple worm. It fit the entire exploit and the body of the worm and everything into a single package. It was 400 bytes long. Didn't need to have an ongoing communication. So if you just... so when it starts up...
Hey, Stefan, your audio is going south.
Still hear me? So, it starts displaying methods similar to a Code Red worm. Basically, every 8.5 seconds, the number of infected hosts doubles. After a minute, it has doubled so much that it has saturated the bandwidth available to the various hosts that are actually vulnerable. So, to certain, you know, individual hosts, 20,000 cases, actually starts to decrease because congestion from the worm itself interferes with the worm. Right? At 3 minutes, the total scanning rate peaks 5 million per second. So, the way to think about that is, you know, all right, 100 million hosts. Covered 100 million hosts. Scans 90% of the internet in 10 minutes. Right, this is the kind of thing that people talked about abstractly beforehand, but it's really driven home. It only ends up infecting about 100,000 hosts because that's the only number of hosts that are vulnerable to this particular exploit. It has nothing to do with how quickly it spreads. So if this was an exploit that was in everyone's test bed machine, this could have infected 100 million hosts in the same period of time. Now, so here's a question for you. Was Slammer a fast worm? And there's 2 points of view on this. One, yes, it was really fast. It was orders of magnitude faster than the fastest worm we had seen before, which was Code Red. The other argument is to say, no, this was a poorly written worm. It had errors in its random number generator. It didn't have congestion control. It was actually not very well done at all. the point that I would really like you to take away with is that it actually is completely irrelevant for all of the design points that we would care about. So at this point, this issue about building a fast worm has become an academic point, because what we already know that we can build a worm that will infect a million hosts on the order of 500 milliseconds. All right, and what academics like me fight about is, can we do it in less than 500 milliseconds or not? And it's not a very interesting question unless this is your specialty, because 500 milliseconds is not enough time to do anything using our current way of doing things. You know, it's like, all right, yeah, the internet's gone. That's the rate at which a real worm can be written today. The bottom line is, people have to get out of the loop for this kind of threat. You cannot have people in the loop and do anything meaningful. So, I'm going to take a moment to try to explain how I think you should think about worms. And don't be scared about the math. You know, I can't integrate anything for real. But I'm going to try to explain this in the abstract. All right? So, most worms can be well fit through relatively simple traditional models, several hundred years old, for infectious epidemics, where you model them as being random, having random homogeneous contacts between different hosts on the network. And there are a handful of variables that you can use to talk about the interesting characteristics of a worm. So what is the size of the population? That's N. At a given point in time, how many hosts are vulnerable, are susceptible to this particular exploit? How many hosts are infected at a given rate? And then how quickly does each instance of the worm try to spread, the contact rate? And so then you have these two equations here. So just look at the one on the top. You can kind of think about it in the following way. DIDT is the change in the rate, how quickly things get infected as a function of time. And it's controlled by two things. One is how quickly an individual host spreads. So beta times the number of infected hosts. And that's really your parallelism, right? How many hosts are spreading and how quickly is each host working? That's the amount of total work you have in the system. So N workers going at beta probes per second. And then S over N is the fraction of hosts left to infect, right? The fraction of hosts that are still susceptible out of the total population. If you pick one at random, what's the probability that you hit them? That's all you really need to understand. You're going to get one of these curves that looks like this. For almost any kind of worm, this particular one's a logistic curve, where in the beginning, it grows relatively slowly because the probability that you hit something is small. They're not too, you know, as a fraction of the population, you expect that not every single host is susceptible. As time goes on, more and more hosts are infected. You get more parallelism. More of them can participate at the same time. At a certain point, you infect more than half of the hosts, and then it's strictly downhill. There are fewer and fewer opportunities for you to infect something that's still susceptible, until at the end it's really hard to find that last susceptible host, but you've done most of the work. Now, the power of this kind of model isn't that this is perfectly right, although you can use it actually for random scanning worms, it's almost a perfect fit. The power is it lets you think about how would I think about treating this, all right? And while there's lots of ways you can improve the model, what you come to conclude is that there really are only two things that you actually care about. When a worm tries to spread to a new host, how likely is it that they will succeed? All right? And there's a number of things that will affect this. How do they pick a target? If it's random, then you can say, all right, this is simply going to be what is the density of this particular vulnerability in the whole system. If at the other extreme, if it's what's called a hit list worm, where they've pre-figured out who all the vulnerable hosts are, then it's going to be 100% probability that they hit someone who actually will be infected. And then the other thing is, how frequently do they try to do this? And this is going to govern how long it takes for a worm to take over. Given that, you can say, all right, well, there are going to be three classes of things I can do as a function of these variables. One is I can reduce the number of susceptible hosts. All right, ideally, I'd like to do this while the number of hosts that are still infected is small. That's prevention. I'll talk about each of these in a little more detail. I can reduce the contact rate. After the thing has broken out, I would like to reduce the rate at which new contacts are being made before too many hosts get infected. And then finally, after the whole thing has been taken over, I can try to reduce the number of hosts that have been infected after the fact, and we call this treatment. Most of the traditional work is in prevention. All right? That's where we've spent most of our time traditionally. There are a number of different ways of doing it. One, write better software. Don't have bugs. All right? do better static and dynamic testing, better process, automated tools. This is a great idea. There's lots of great resources. Dave referred to this in his talk last week. There's an active research community. It's taken incredibly seriously in industry. All right, Microsoft in particular, I mean, one fact that I don't think Dave mentioned in his talk, when they were releasing Windows Server 2003, the cost for the security code review alone was on the order of $200 million. All right, so significant effort gets put into this. The problem is, it's not enough. Right? We still have bugs, and it's unrealistic, I think, to assume that any time in the next decade we're going to be in a situation where our software does not have exploitable bugs. So we continue to push along this avenue, but we can't assume that it's going to solve the problem for us. Another thing you can do is, all right, I can't solve all the individual software, but I'm going to wrap it with something. All right? I'm going to stop the vulnerability from being exploited by getting... Was there a question? All right. I'm going to stop the vulnerability from being exploited by putting some piece of software or hardware in the way. So, for example, for buffer overflows, we have a variety of technologies. Intel has something called NX that allows you to prevent stack pages from being executed. There's the compiler flags in the Microsoft compiler to prevent obvious kinds of stack overflows, tools like StackGuard and so forth. You can also take your application and do what's called sandboxing it. Put it in an environment in which its capabilities are limited. So even if it, in fact, is exploited, you're going to limit what it can do, so maybe it can't go and contact other hosts and subsequently infect them. A more out there idea is to reduce the impact of a vulnerability by creating heterogeneity, right? Using the biological metaphor, the reason we don't all fall down dead when some new thing comes out is because some of us are immune or some of us have a higher tolerance to it and others don't, because all of our different immune systems and genomes are set up to be a little bit different. We don't have that at all in the software base, so we have it to a far more minor extent. So we'd like to find a way to engender greater diversity so that we can resist any particular exploit that targets a particular set of invariants won't work across the entire base of software. And the two classes of work in this area, one is to exploit existing heterogeneity, and you actually see this in, not only in research systems, but you'll see companies who will, say, provision different networks from different providers, and they want the different networks to be running software by different switch manufacturers for exactly this reason, so they won't have some big correlated failure. And so there's work to try to do this kind of stuff, and in fact, this is the kind of thing the insurance industry pays attention to for controls. What fraction of your shop runs Mac? What fraction runs Windows? What fraction runs Linux? And they can use that to figure out what some of their liability might be. The other area, which is a kind of a hotter topic for research, is creating artificial heterogeneity. So it's not that there's actually independently created software, but maybe you take the same software specification or actually at the source code level, but then in its translation down to machine code, you perturb it in various ways. So it's semantically equivalent, but actually each individual instance of it is different. The stack is located in a different place. The control flow graph goes in a different order. The heap is offset in a different way. So any particular invariant that an exploit might want to take advantage of, like the location of different libraries and so forth, won't work. The first person who proposed this, to my knowledge, was Stephanie Forrest back in 1997. And at the time, people thought she was totally nuts. And they said, all right, the support cost of this thing is going to be insane because everyone who calls in saying they have a bug is going to have a different version of Windows. What are we going to do? Over the last decade, it has acquired, I think, a lot more acceptance. And you see versions of this, limited versions of this, actually running in systems like Linux and emerging in systems like Windows, because it does help against certain classes of attacks. Now, the open question here is, what class of vulnerabilities can you really protect against? What things can you really mask? And which things are just wrong in the source code? And no amount of messing around with what registers get used is actually going to change that. We also have this issue of patching. Update your software. All right. So we know that most worms and viruses exploit vulnerabilities that are already known on the order of 1 day to 3 months ahead of time. While this window is shrinking because now we have these automated tools, for turning a patch into an exploit, there's still this opportunity for you to distribute this patch very quickly and then prevent yourself from being exploited when the actual piece of code comes out. There are real reasons why this doesn't happen, though, and they tend to have to do with the fact that code is very fragile. So when you add a patch to some system, particularly a complex system that's being used in lots of different ways by lots of people, it's likely to break. And if it's broken at least once before, your average organization doesn't want to run it again. Right? They want to test before they actually put it on anything mission critical. So QA is actually a really big deal. Microsoft spends a lot of time doing QA before they'll even release it to make sure that it's not going to crash systems. And then the individual organizations want to QA it, this patch, with respect to their applications before they in turn deploy it on their system. This creates a pretty long window before you actually get to deploy. And there's actually this interesting paper that Eric Roscoro, I think is talking next week, gave, kind of looking at the economic value in actually finding bugs. The argument being that for a large part of the parameter space for reasonable models of the value of finding these bugs versus not announcing them, it might be better just not to find them at all. Right? Don't tell anyone that there's a bug. And in so doing, you may actually expose people to less harm than actually trying to fix them. Somewhat controversial point, but I thought it was a really interesting way of looking at it. So to deal with this fragility at the code level, what a number of people have tried to do is to do this patching, but not by changing the code, but doing it at the network level. So coming up with kind of approximate patches that you can apply lexically. So let's suppose you wanted to stop a slammer worm that was this buffer overflow. It was going to a buffer on a particular port that had to be more than 60 bytes long. You could put a rule, once you know that you have this vulnerability, you put a rule in your network stack that says anytime I get a packet that's destined to 1434 and it's more than 60 bytes, just drop it. All right? And there's a nice bit of work from Microsoft that does a much more elaborate version of this that models the state machine and so forth called Shield. And there's a commercial version of this from Symantec called generic exploit blocking, where they try to represent in a generic fashion what is this vulnerability, match things that come in for that vulnerability, and then drop them at the network level. And because it's at the network level, if you get it wrong, the whole system doesn't crash. You might not get some communication in, but it's not as fragile a change. Then by far the most common form of prevention is you have some known exploit and you block it. This is the antivirus industry in a nutshell. The way it works, they get some early samples of a new exploit. They have some network sensors and honeypots out there. They get samples that are sent in by the writers. These are called zoo samples because they never appear in the wild. A little known fact is that 99% of all viruses that your antivirus program checks have never been released in the wild. They were just released by the authors to prove that they could get around the latest version of Symantec and say, aha, and they send them to them, and that's it. So most of this stuff never appears. Then they go and they have a human go and distill a signature, and this can take, it can be anywhere between minutes and weeks to actually get this right. The signature gets pushed out to customers. The customers run the antivirus software on their host. It has some kind of recognizer. The recognizers are actually incredibly sophisticated. Before I got into this area, I thought of antivirus programs as doing grep on, you know, files and memory. In fact, they're doing virtual machines where they do instruction emulation. And when you are running antivirus on your system, there is actually an incredibly sophisticated piece of software running there that is executing part of your files on your behalf for you before you actually execute them. So an example, you know, Symantec, they have this thing called the Deep Site Network, and they have a managed service business that lets them learn early about new things as people are testing new exploits. And then they push out 60 terabytes of signatures each day out to all of their customers, and that's their model. This works fairly well if you have a long reaction window. It takes a long time between when you first get a sample of one of these things and it becomes prevalent. Finally, the last part of prevention is hygiene enforcement. So, and this is newer than the rest, but the idea is if you have hosts that might be susceptible, keep them off the network. All right? Make sure that people have well-cared-for machines before you allow them to talk to your network, recently patched, up-to-date antivirus, you know, all of this good stuff. So Cisco has this thing called Network Admission Control. This is basically the automated version. When you try to connect, say, to their router, it first queries you to make sure that you have all this good stuff on your machine, and if you don't, you don't get an IP address. This is the automated version of what happens when you go to NSF today, and they manually go and check your laptop to make sure that you have all this stuff. Otherwise, you're not allowed to connect to the network. All right. So that's prevention. We would like it to work. It doesn't. All right. It helps. And it's an area where we continue to push. But the fact of the matter is we have stuff that is going to break out. And what we want to do then is try to contain it, limit the damage. This is going to be a reactive kind of response where we want to figure out that something bad has happened and reduce the rate of it spreading until we can block it off. So one thing you can do is just slow things down. All right. So Matt Williamson had this observation that the flexibility that the Internet offers you and being able to talk to anyone at any rate you want is a flexibility that most of us don't use. Right? So most of us don't need our host to be able to talk to a million hosts in a minute. That's not core to most of the applications we use. So if instead you actually restrict that a little bit and say, I'm not going to allow any given host to talk to more than 10 hosts per minute, or pick your number. We can actually do things such that you won't notice it, because everything that you normally do will be completely acceptable, but it will dramatically slow down the rate at which some contagion can spread through the network. And you see actually this in some of the HP ProCurve switches. They have this built in. Now this is going to slow things down, but any one of these contagions will continue to spread. And so what you'd like to really do is be able to quarantine the thing. Figure out that it's spreading, detect it, and blocking it from spreading more. And that's going to be, after the next slide, the rest of the talk. I'm going to discuss the ways in which people are building systems to do that. Finally, the other thing that we really spend a lot of time doing is treatment. So after you infect the host, after the outbreak is done and it's basically infected all the vulnerable hosts, you mop up. Right? And most of our time is spent mopping up because there really is no meaningful containment defense that's deployed out there. You have two issues in doing this. One is, how do you detect what hosts are infected? And there are really two methods. The traditional method is your host is spewing because it's trying to infect everyone in the internet, and your sysadmin sends you a note saying your host is sending 100 million packets a second trying to infect the rest of the internet. I've shut it off. Please fix it. This approach depends on a property that worms spread indefinitely, which unfortunately is a poor assumption. So Justin Ma had a nice paper recently where he showed that, in fact, you can make a worm very simply that spreads, infects the whole vulnerable population, then just shuts up and becomes a sleeper. The other thing is you can build a custom detector. You can build a piece of software that detects a particular infection and tries to find it and say, this host is infected, and make everybody run it. So when you download the Microsoft malware, whatever the thing is called, that's what it's doing. There are a set of, 100 things that it looks for and says, are any of those on your machine? You have this other problem, though. Once you figure out that your machine is infected, what do you do? All right? The easiest thing to do, and what a number of organizations do, is just wipe the whole machine, start over. Right? Because you can't really depend on anything. So one model is, you can say, I know what this thing does. I'll build a custom disinfector that undoes. Every piece of state that it changes, I will undo that thing. The problem with this approach is a lot of these things, there are a lot of different variants, so you have to feel really confident you got exactly that variant, and they leave back doors. So they leave openings that people can subsequently log in. Moreover, you don't know what they did. So kind of, here's a little aside. How many people know what Senate Bill 1386 is? All right. All of you know. You just don't know it. This is the one that forces people to send you a notification when your private information has been compromised in the state of California. So I get about one of these a month saying someone has stolen some combination of your name and social security number. So the wording of this is that you have to notify if you have reasonable expectation that people's private information has been compromised. What do you think you should do with a host that's been infected by a worm that may have left a back door that happens to store a credit card database? Is that a reasonable expectation? All right? The answer is, who knows if it's reasonable or not? No one defines that as a reasonable expectation. And the reason is, if they did, we would all be getting these notices many times a day. Right? Because there are thousands and thousands and thousands of hosts in California infected by worms. No company I have talked to, including the University of California, is willing to declare a host that has been corrupted by a worm. It doesn't matter, backdoors, they can put all kinds of stuff on there. They're not willing to classify that as a 1386 violation, because they'd be telling you all day that your private information has been lost. All right, so let's suppose you want to actually block a worm that's spreading. We did some work thinking about how would you build an abstract defense. So let's ignore what the technical details are of building a defense that would detect a worm and respond. But let's just talk about it in terms of abstract metric. So how quickly does this black box defense system react after there's an outbreak? How does it identify and stop the malicious activity? So the two versions we're going to look at is one is when you identify individual hosts as being bad and you say, all right, we won't talk to those hosts anymore, they've been infected. The other is where you identify a particular kind of communication is bad. Here is a signature for the worm, don't allow this communication. And then finally, how many people participate in the actual activity? And so given the, kind of looking at it abstractly, what are the requirements for building something that would actually contain a real worm? Not even the fastest one, let's just say like a Code Red style one. Alright? What you're going to find is that it's really tough. Alright, so even if you have universal deployment, by universal I mean every host on the internet deploys a defense system. If you want to contain a Code Red worm, style worm, such that less than 10% of the vulnerable hosts are infected in a 24-hour period, you're going to need to be able to automatically respond, even though you had no idea what this was, on the order of 25 minutes. All right, some new thing comes out in 25 minutes, you need to be able to say, this guy and this guy and this guy and this guy are infected, don't talk to them, and tell everyone on the internet that this is the case. You get a little more leeway if you can actually talk about the kind of speech that is bad. Here is a particular bit pattern that if it appears on your network, you should drop it because this is an infection. Then you have 3 hours. All right? It has to be done in that time frame for you to do this. If you have a faster worm like Slammer, these times get dramatically compressed down to on the order of, you know, tens of seconds. If you have non-universal deployment, like maybe everyone in the world doesn't deploy this thing, then you have to be even faster. Alright? So for worms that people have actually released, not even anticipating the next generation, you're talking order of seconds or fractions of a second that you actually would need to do this in an automated fashion, detect what's going on, tell everyone on the planet, get them to respond and do something in order to contain it. Alright, so I'm going to talk about how people are attempting to do that. And a lot of it goes down to, first, how do you detect what new outbreaks occur? And there really are, there's two orthogonal issues going to this. One is, for detecting a threat, what do you use monitors that are at the network level or at the host level? So at the network, life is really easy. You tap into a network and you say, I'm going to look at all the traffic and find the worm-like stuff that goes on. And I have the advantage that I can correlate between different hosts and figure out this is happening on a lot of different places, and that tells me if there's some big activity going on. Challenge you have is making this fast enough and making sure you understand what the hell is going on. If you just have bits flying back and forth, you don't really know what they're doing. At the other end of the system, you can actually do this in host. Individual endpoints run intrusion detection software and figure out exactly what's going on. This particular piece of code executed, overflowed this buffer, I know it's bad. Gives you an idealized vantage point to say this is a bad thing, but now you have this deployment problem because you have to have all these hosts actually build this thing. An orthogonal dimension is, do you monitor real live hosts and networks with real live traffic trying to see real live infections going on, or do you have kind of an ex situ approach where you set up a device solely for the purpose of being infected? You put it out on the internet and see what happens to it. Honeypots, honeynets are in this category. There are a number of different versions of these combinations that tend to occur in practice. So one is this idea of a network telescope that got developed here at UCSD and a number of other places. Incredibly simple idea. You stick a monitor on the network and watch traffic come into it. There's nothing. It's looking at addresses that have no host behind it. It's a quiet network. There's nothing really there. The only reason anyone would ever send you traffic is because they were trying to do something to you. There's nothing legitimate there for them to talk to. And so the nice thing about this is it's incredibly scalable. You just sit there and watch packets come into you, we have a single machine that monitors 17 million IP addresses simultaneously and has no trouble doing so. So almost every study that's been done so far about the growth of various different kinds of worms has used this particular approach. Now the downside is you really don't know very much, right? Because these are totally passive entities. They don't do anything. They can't even respond to a handshake request from a transport protocol like TCP. So if you get a SYN packet indicating I want to start a connection, do you know if that is being initiated by someone who's infected by Code Red or by Welchia or some other worm? You have no idea. You don't know what the payload looks like because you haven't been able to elicit more information of the communication. You're just, all you know is that someone tried to talk to you. The one solution is to say, all right, let's make it a little bit less passive and we'll just have it respond. We'll have it, this is the equivalent of when someone says knock, knock on your door, you say, who's there? Right? You have a little box that always says who's there whenever anybody knocks. So these things send little proxy responses trying to elicit a little bit more communication from the other side so that they can get some more intelligence on what it is that they're talking to. And this has been fairly successful in a number of projects, notably this thing called the Internet Motion Sensor out of Michigan. The problem with this approach is you still don't know what the thing will do. All right? It never really executes code. You don't actually see it infect anything. And you certainly don't get to see the command and control behavior of any of these applications that people are deploying. A lot of times, the very first thing that one of these infections will do is try to download the latest version of the code that gives it new capabilities, kind of phone home. All right? So the solution is what's called a honeypot. You put a real infectable machine out there on the network, and you let it get infected. But the advantage you have is you can monitor it very closely. And since no one is doing anything legitimate with this machine, you know that you don't have a lot of problems with false positives because the only people who are ever talking to it are people who are trying to compromise it. You can do this with individual hosts, with virtual machines. There are systems that will automatically generate a signature, either by looking at bit strings coming in off the network, or there's some very new projects, both from Microsoft and some folks in the UC system and Carnegie, that will actually look at the code execution and try to figure out what are the various paths through the code that could lead this vulnerability to be exploited. So automatically generate a signature for the whole class of so the challenges here, one, are scalability. So for each one of these things, you need to buy a box. All right, so you're not going to get 17 million of them. There's a tremendous liability issue, which I'll talk about a little bit later, because you're knowingly allowing yourself to become infected, and you may in turn do damage to somebody else. You need to make sure that things are isolated from one another, because more and more we now have contagions that the very first thing they try to do is shut out the other one. Because a lot of these, one way of looking at it is, since compromised machines are the platform, different groups that are competing to offer this service to people have an economic incentive to shut each other out of each other's territory. So you want to be able to control whether or not these things mix. And then finally, because a number of companies like Symantec have started to use honeypots for various purposes, there's now code in the wild that tries to detect if they're running in a virtualized environment and then do something different. All right, so I'm going to talk really briefly about some work that we've done in this space. Traditionally, there's been this trade-off between scalability, that is how big a system of honeypots you can build, and fidelity, that is how precisely it mimics a real live machine that would get infected. So on the extreme level of scalability, you have network telescopes that just sit there and slurp packets up, but really don't look anything like what a real host experiences. On the other end, you have someone just putting a machine and plonking it down and putting it on the network. That's going to experience the same behavior that a real person would, but for each one of those, you need to buy a machine. And you really have to choose either or. So we built a system to try to unify these two ideas, to give you your cake and eat it too, as it were, so that you could have high scale and high fidelity. And the observation is that you don't really need to have a real host for all of the addresses that you want to have a honeypot for. You only need to provide the illusion that you have that host. If no one comes knocking at the door, then you don't actually need to have anyone there at the other side. fact, most addresses out there are idle at any given period of time. So the idea is we will multiplex address space. We'll have packets coming in off of the internet, and then if a packet arrives for a given address, we will route it to a machine and tell that machine right now become that identity, pretend to be that IP address. And for that, and until we discover that that was an interesting communication or not, and when that's done, we can just recycle that physical machine. So we really only need as many physical machines that there are active communications going on, not as many as there are potential communications. On top of that, you can really push hard on virtual machines and exploit the fact that on a given, say, Linux box, all of the different machines that are, say, running Linux with Apache have basically the same stuff in memory. When you issue a query to a Linux box saying, all right, I want to download a web page, only a couple megabytes of memory actually changes. Most of the memory in that whole system is absolutely unchanged. So what you might decide to do then is say, all right, well, I'm just going to have 100 or 1,000 copies of that same machine running on one host, and they'll just share memory. I only need to have unique memory relative to the number of distinct platforms, the number of distinct, unique changes that get made to the memory. So that the end product of this is that you can build a system that will be on the order of, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not up to about 1 million hosts, that becomes affordable, and yet really is running Windows NT and all this other stuff. All right, so I'm behind, so I'm going to try to accelerate. All right, so one thing I want to talk about really briefly is this issue of containment that applies to any of these honeypot-style approaches that anybody does. All right, normally when you just have a host, if you run an antivirus software and so forth, you are in a safe harbor of following best practice. As soon as you run a honeypot, you're really in trouble because you have purposefully exposed the machine that is vulnerable to be infected, and it may in turn infect other hosts. All right. Any hope of claiming that you are following best practice has been thrown out the window, and now you have effectively done premeditated negligence. You have knowingly infected third parties. And so it now behooves you to have something that prevents this host from infecting others. It turns out to be very challenging to do that and allow the breadth of communication that would really let you see what the bad guys do. Because the bad guys, first thing they do is phone home and say, get some more software. I want to talk to my command and control network. And you have no way of knowing, well, are they just getting information or are they actually hurting somebody? And so it becomes very challenging to actually make this fly. In general, honeypot systems have this problem that they depend on someone trying to infect them, which they may not do. You have this trade-off between liability and your ability to actually figure out what the thing is actually doing. And it doesn't necessarily reflect what's happening on your network, just what's happening out there in some random piece of the internet. So there's also a need to do analysis that works on real systems. All right, so I am going to... What am I going to do, given my 5 minutes? I'm going to breeze through really quickly two classes of things that people do. One is scan detection. So you sit there, the idea of scan detection is you're going to detect hosts that are infected based on their infection attempts. So a particular host starts trying to talk to a lot of other hosts, that's a clue that there's something wrong with them. Most of the time when you send a packet to a host, you first look up their DNS address. If your particular host is sending packets to a lot of different destinations but isn't ever talking to DNS, that's a clue that they're doing something very unusual. So there's a whole class of detectors that work trying to detect the infection activity and then identifying that host as likely being infected. Another approach is what I call signature inference, where you want to generate a signature, and by signature I mean some textual string, that can then be used to filter that communication out in the future. So kind of here's an example of a signature in a dump of a packet. It says, all right, if it's going to port 5000 and it's the TCP protocol and it has those red bytes at the bottom, then that's bad. And in fact, this is an instance of a worm called the Kivu B worm. So there's some work that's been done here and a number of other places developing a generic approach to try to learn these things and learn them very quickly. It's called content sifting. And I'm just going to give you an intuition for it and then skip to the end. All right? So here's the intuition. Let's suppose there is a signature that exists. Let's suppose there is something you could learn that is a signature for a given worm. So there's some bit string that exists that is the same in every instance of the worm. That's an assumption. If that's true, there are going to be two other things that are true. That bit string is going to be much more common than other bit strings of the same length. The reason for that is that the worm is spreading across the network. So there's going to be multiple copies as the worm spreads. By definition, each instance of the worm carries W with it. It's going to happen once, it'll happen twice, it'll happen three times as it grows. There's going to be more and more of the string W, whereas the string, you know, dear mom, I had a bad day at camp, appears just once when I write the letter. The other consequence is going to be that if you look on the packet, at the packets that carry that bit string, and say, where do they come from? How many distinct sources and destinations do they come from? It's going to be much higher than other pieces of content that are that popular, because the worm is spreading. It's, by definition, going from host to host to host to host to host. Lots of different people will carry it. So if you just look for this characteristic, bit strings that have high prevalence, high what we call dispersion, it turns out this is an almost perfect signature for a worm. And you can discover this and then tell everyone, block this. And the part that I'm going to skip is some intuition for how we do this. I'm just going to go ahead because you can get it out of a paper. The problem with this approach at the network level is that it's pretty easy to evade. All right? So I can build, in fact, people do build pieces of malicious code where each instance are different. They encrypt themselves or they recompile themselves. So every single instance has a different set of instructions in a different order. There's this crazy Russian guy named Zombies who builds this code that inserts the malware in between the instructions of arbitrary applications like Excel and then relinks them together. And so you don't even know that it exists. It's kind of strung through all the stuff on your hard disk. Really, really hard to find this stuff. There is no textual invariant. All right? It turns out that you can also hide in the network by crafting these packets so there's ambiguity about what actually got received. And then if you do end-to-end encryption, then you're really, then there's nothing you can do at the network level. So there's a, I'll skip the denial of service part. All right, well, I have no time. But there's some other issues which I'm not going to talk about. One thing I would try to communicate from this is a really vibrant area. There's a huge amount of research that's been done really in just the last 2 years, both in industry and in academia, that are making it feasible for you to do these kind of, in a fraction of a second, I will defend the whole internet, which was really inconceivable 2 or 3 years ago when we first started talking about the limitations. At the same time, it remains a situation where the diligent bad guy is a lot better off than the diligent good guy. So, you know, the average graduate student can easily defeat the really great graduate student if they take the position of the bad guy. But that's about it, so I'll take any questions.
Steven?
Questions?
In Berkeley?
We have one question here, and then I'll take Berkeley.
Great.
Repeat the question. We can't hear a thing.
I'll repeat the question. So the question was about various kinds of algorithms to minimize the liability of honeypot systems by correlating the patterns of traffic. If I send something out and nothing bad happens, then I can allow it out in the future, or the inverse of that, something like that. A lot of work goes into exactly this kind of question when you work in this area. You try your best to come up with resources. Let me give you an example. A reasonable thing you might do is say, all right, I'm going to hold any packet before I send it out and see if this particular host that's a honeypot sends a huge spew of packets. And if it does, then I'll say, oh, it's trying to spread. I won't let anything through. If it sends one, then I'll say, well, maybe it's trying to phone home. And I'll let that one through. But these are all heuristics. And so then the question becomes, at what point can you claim to have done your due diligence with respect to protecting the world at large? We run into a lot of these problems. If I accidentally do infect someone, what is my obligation to disclose? All right, for onesies and twosies, it seems pretty obvious from an ethical standpoint. I should tell them, oops, I screwed up. I'm a grad student and I infected your host. I'm really sorry. What if I accidentally infect a million? Right? And what if, in the meantime, a billion were being infected by other people? Do I still have obligations there? It's very much a gray area. Every time we ask our lawyer, they say, oh, you have such good questions. Berkeley question.
So I'm interested in this story about Code Red, which sounds like people saw it and they thought, and they look at it and they say, "Ah, that's not such a big deal. It's not so clever." And then, you know, 10 hours later, you get hammered with it. How predictable is it, even to the author, that a worm will be successful? Because after all, you can write clever code, but the internet, in some sense, is an object of study for us now. We don't really know the dynamics very well. And there's actually an analog in infectious disease that it's nice to write down these second-order differential equations, but we probably aren't smart enough to predict if we see a new bug whether it'll be a raging infection or just sort of peter out. It's an empirical subject for us now. How well do we know in advance whether something like Code Red will work?
So here's what I think it really comes down to. I think it really comes down to how robust an exploit do you have? So, and how widespread is that particular vulnerability? If the vulnerability is widespread, an exploit that will robustly take advantage of all the hosts that have the vulnerability, the mechanics of how you make the worm spread quickly, I think are pretty much a solved science. I mean, you might not get third order effects, but we know how to build a worm that will take everything out in a very short period of time. Now, it remains to be, there's a question, how do you develop such a thing and make sure you didn't make a coding error? Because Microsoft doesn't have an IDE like the worm tester that you get to run and see how well things do. But I actually think that is not, the spreading is actually not a hard problem, particularly for those who are both educated and incented monetarily to do the right thing.
But what's the limiting factor? I mean, how come we aren't awash in these things?
Well, so let me, there's a number of reasons I'd say. One is that you are awash in them, you just don't know it. All right? So when people go and catch someone running a botnet, it's now routine for them to own hundreds of thousands of hosts. Now, they may not have spread in the most obvious fashion. It may not have been pure epidemic spreading. They may have taken over some bots and then told them to infect other people at various points in time, so a little more stealthy. But in fact, there are millions of compromised hosts out there on the open market. I guarantee you that Berkeley is full of hosts that are compromised. As to why they're, I think the really big, obvious worms happen less because it's not clear that they need them in order to make the kinds of profits that people need. But that's the best explanation I have. It's not that there aren't vulnerabilities, it's not...
Oops. Perfect timing. Okay, your audio went out at just the right moment because we have to context switch to Vern. So let's declare a 5-minute context switch and start up again, okay?